Welcome, Dr. Kepler. I'm going to change the focus now a little bit to a real advocacy kind of focus. And I'm here representing a coalition, the Student Health Advocacy Coalition. And so what I'm going to say really it reflects the work of many people, and I'll give credit to the organizations. And co-author on the paper, although she's not here now, is Elaine Auld, who is the executive director, CEO of SOFE, the Society of Public Health Educators, which is also a member of the SHAC. And I have no relationships to disclose. So we're talking about policy collaboration between health and education sectors for healthy youth. And part of the thing to realize is that school health is really the intersection of various sectors. And we have to, if we're going to be effective in the area, understand that each sector has its own needs, its own responsibilities, and its own lingo and that type of thing. So if we're going to be good advocates, we have to be working collaboratively and understand one another. So school health is sort of at the intersection of at least two systems, the education and health, but there are also others, the environment, the community, family, transportation, agricultural planning, etc. And some of these were already mentioned in the previous discussion. And when we talk about health, we are talking about it broadly. We're talking about health. We're also talking about medical conditions, physical health, and behavioral health. So why should we in public health care about what happens in schools and the intersection here? Well, they are interconnected. So we know that one of healthy people's goals is high school graduation, because we know that an educated populace is also a healthier populace. People that graduate from high school tend to be healthier throughout life. So the academic performance relates to educational attainment, relates to adult health status, relates to child health status, and there are ways that schools can be engaged in all of that. So whether you're working in schools or not, if you want to have a healthier populace, looking at what's going on in the schools and helping to make them healthier has public health implications and has value to public health. The other part of it is that if you're not in public health but you're in education, why should you care about health? I mean, if I'm a school superintendent or a school principal, I don't lose my job because the kids are obese or because they're not fit. I lose my job because of test scores. So, you know, why should I do something? I care about kids' health, but that's not what I'm responsible for. So we have to be able to understand where the schools are coming from if we want to be effective in terms of advocacy. So first of all, realizing that if we are interested in worksite wellness, that in many communities, schools are major employers. And so, you know, it is a work site. So we're looking at the health of students, but we're also looking at the health of the faculty and staff that are there. And with work site wellness, there's pretty good evidence that if the healthy staff and faculty, they're good role models, they're more likely to do healthy things with the kids, but it also saves the district money. Because there's less absenteeism, their health insurance rates can go down. So if you're trying to make a case for this with a school administrator, sometimes money talks. And that can be one of the factors in terms of money. So some of the things that I mentioned before about the value of education to health, we'll skip that. Some of you may have seen this before. This is called the whole school child model. It's come out recently from jointly from two organizations, sort of CDC, who obviously has a public health bent, but also ASCD, the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development. And ASCD has been one of the leaders for education reform and really represents the education sector. And they took what was the traditional comprehensive or according to school health model, and which is what's in the blue, made sure that the focus of it was in the child, which is the center, the whole child, and the whole child is healthy and safe, engaged in school and community, supported, as well as challenged. And then there are coordinating policies, processes, and practices that are needed to improve both learning and improving health. And on the school, the yellow indicates that schools are part of community and they are not isolated. And what happens in the school is affected by the community and affects what goes on in the community and with the family. So if we're talking about advocacy and why we should be engaged and why we should care for our public health point of view, it's really that it is part of public health to be involved with schools. So a healthy school environment is essential for healthy students and staff, and the way we get there is often through policy, environment, and systems change approaches, if we're really looking at this systemically. And it does require that we work with and through the education systems. We can't be going in and bringing health to the schools without understanding something of how schools work and what their priorities are and how we can help them be successful, not how can they help us be successful. So I want to help you understand a little bit, for those of you who are not familiar with schools, a little bit about the political structure of schools. I mean, we all grew up and we went to school, so we know something about schools, but sometimes you don't understand all of the politics of it just because you were a student. So there are multiple levels where there might be influence. There is the federal level, and federal policy really, there's a lot of conversation about it, and I'm going to talk about it more in a little bit, but other than financial incentives to schools, there's really not a lot that the federal government has authority over in the education system. Education in the Constitution is reserved for the states. And so it really is, you'll see governors have a lot of responsibility. Some of you might have heard of something called the Common Core, which is a big thing in education now. That came out of the National Governors Association. It was not a federal initiative, although there are people in the right-wing media that think that it is a right-wing, or it's a left-wing conspiracy or something. But it was from the governors, because the governors have that responsibility. Within states, then there are districts, and then there, in some districts, large districts, or maybe clusters, sometimes they include the feeder schools that go into a high school. So in some districts are only composed of one high school in the feeder schools. Some districts are bigger than some state systems. LA County, for instance, LA City, the huge, huge district. And then there's the building level. And there are, a lot of states, this depends on the state, a lot of states give over a lot of authority for schools to the district level. So they have the authority, but they allow for local control. And then, in many instances, there's building level control. So I remember when wellness policies were first mandated in schools, and one of the things I was working with some schools on, trying to get district level policy related to what would be in vending machines, and the superintendent said, we have no authority over what's in the vending machines in the schools, the principals have that authority. So if you're trying to influence school policy, it's not, you can't just be at one level and you're going to affect what happens in the schools. It's all these levels and all levels of authority and all levels of decision making. Understanding what's at your school and how you can impact that. Also at the school, at the district level, most cases there are elected school boards. So there are elected school boards, which sort of have a governance authority. the set policy, and then there are the superintendents and the principals, and then often what happens in the cafeteria or what happens in the classroom is up to the teacher. There may or may not be a, for instance, in health, a lot of school districts don't have a curriculum that's a district-wide curriculum, so they sometimes leave it up to the teachers, you know. So I remember when my son was in high school, the health curriculum, the phys ed teachers divided the health course up in high school by each of them took 2 weeks because none of them wanted to just do that. And none of them wanted to talk about sex. So in high school, he never had sex education because that just wasn't something that any of them wanted to talk about. So a question. How many of you here in the room know who the school board members are in the district where you live? Okay, very good. How many of you have spoken to them about anything related to school health? Very good. Okay, so this is probably an unusual audience. Because that's often where, if you're going to be doing policy kinds of things at the local level, you probably need to be knowing how to do that and doing advocacy work. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears, and the SHAC, the Student Health Advocacy Coalition that I'm talking about and I'm representing here, does work at the national level. So you all be working at the local level, whether you're working at other levels also, but we all are at the local level. So a few years ago, there was a decision that there needed to be an advocacy group that could help work at the national level on school health issues, because if legislators don't hear about something, it doesn't exist, it's not important, and so we're not going to give it any attention. Some of the, there are two kinds of legislation federally. There are authorizing legislation and appropriations kinds of legislation. So authorizing allows something. It doesn't necessarily mean there's any money for it. And that type of legislation often is good for a long period of time. The appropriations are every year, and is there actual money for the things that are allowed. So just because something's allowed doesn't mean there's any money behind it. So when there are advocacy efforts, it might be on authorizing or it might be on appropriations. Some of the authorizations, ESEA is Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and that is commonly known now. The current act is No Child Left Behind. It is past authorization. It was supposed to have been for, I think, 6 years. The 6 years ended two or three years ago. There are bills before Congress on that. But we're sort of on a continuing authorization right now. IDEA was Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, so this relates to a lot of the special education programs that are in schools. There is also the Child Nutrition Act, which is also up for authorization now. And then there are some other things in federal law related to school-based health centers. Are they considered federally qualified health centers or not? And that has implications for whether they can collect funding or not. Will schools be reimbursed through Medicaid for services that are provided to students in schools? So there are things like this in addition that have sort of policy implications. When it comes to the appropriations, there are several places where there are appropriations that go to schools. The U.S. Department of Education obviously has some appropriations that go to schools, although the majority of school money is local or state from property taxes, which has its own good and bad. There are some money from Centers for Medicare, particularly if there's allowable for Medicaid reimbursement for services. CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has a small amount of money that's mostly working at the state level to help support what happens in schools. HRSA has some funding, maternal and child health, that sometimes goes to school nursing programs. depends on how they want to do it. The U.S. Department of Agriculture runs the child nutrition program, so all the school meals, the school lunches, the school breakfasts are funded through that. U.S. Department of Transportation can fund school buses, safe routes to schools, programs like that. And EPA does things related to sun safety and environmental protection and school siting. So there are lots of opportunities for having influence on what goes on in schools at the federal level. It's probably about 20 years ago now, there was a couple of members of Congress. It was bipartisan. Lois Capps and Connie Morella, who decided to create a bipartisan school health congressional caucus. And when we heard about that, those of us in school health said, well, we need to have a support group external that can help support this caucus. So we created Friends of School Health. And the core issue that we could all agree on was funding for CDC's school health program at that time. And that's sort of what unified us. But there were other issues that we also addressed. It was staffed by an organization, the Society of State Leaders for Health and Physical Education. That group then lost its funding. They sort of faltered and quasi-disappeared. Friends of School Health sort of faltered. And then about 5 years ago, there was a remnant of us who had been involved that decided, well, we really need to revitalize this because there are things going on that we really do need to have a voice, especially after the No Child Left Behind legislation that was passed before that had core content and did not include health education, physical education. And so we really need to get the advocacy going on this. So we changed the name from Friends of School Health, because a lot of times people in Congress, they didn't really know why you were wanting the school to be healthy. And so if you focus it on kids, that sometimes sells better for legislators. So we called it the Student Health Advocacy Coalition. And we are very aware that we need both the health sector and the education sector involved in our organization if we're going to be effective and we're going to be good advocates, not only in terms of having the credibility, but so that we as advocates know what the issues are and why there might be support, why there might be opposition in various sectors for things that we're supporting in terms of school health. So this is the mission. It's a coalition of national organizations dedicated to improving the health and well-being of all pre-K to 12 children and youth through collective advocacy and policy change, and it is specifically at the federal level. These are some of the goals. So you can see that there's a focus on the connection between health and learning. It wants to be a network of organizations that are supporting this, and we want to engage national leaders. Some of the SHAC members are listed here, just to give you an example, but in the uploaded handouts, so if you go to this section, this session on APHA, in addition to having access to the slides, there are handouts. And the handouts for this one are the goals, but on the back is a list of the 38 organizations that are currently members of SHAC. So if you want to see who they are. So I tried to give just an example of a few of them. APHA is a member, but there are also education organizations. There are ones that are specifically interested in food and nutrition, ones with physical activity, ones with family engagement, ones with violence, ones with sexuality. So just about every aspect of school health is involved in this, and we always welcome more members. This past year, we've had congressional briefings. This shows one that we did a couple of years ago when the Whole Child was launched. We actually decided that when we were doing a congressional briefing, we wanted to model good educational techniques, so we didn't just talk at them, but we engaged people around the table, had conversations, and a lot of the legislative aides said, wow, we've never, usually it's just, come and listen and talk, and so they really sort of responded to that. In 2015, some of the folks I were the reauthorization, as I mentioned earlier, of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Currently, there are two bills. There's a House version and a Senate version. And I'm going to put a little plug in here. The House version eliminates a lot of what's in the current education bill that supports school health. So it eliminates funding for programs. And the Senate version, on the other hand, keeps most of those programs that we care about, including counseling, funding for physical education programs. And it keeps the concept of core subjects, where the House bill eliminates that completely. But it does add to the core subjects, health education and physical education. So we've been working on that for 10 years. We're really happy that at least it got into one version of the bill. We hope that that will go through. So we are, and there is thought that now that the budget compromise has occurred on the Hill, which happened last week, that Congress might turn its attention to some other things that need attention, and that because there are both of these bills there, it's possible that these might actually move. So we're trying to keep an eye on that. Appropriations always for CDC, as well as education, if those bills get passed. We have been doing outreach to the Budget Committee to try to get more budget, which happened. We've also been having meetings with the Office of Management and Budget, so we decided it's not just Congress, but it's also once you get into the regulatory and the executive branch. So Office of Management and Budget actually drafts the President's budget. So we want them to know that people are interested in school health and watching it, and that's important. And meetings with members of the Department of Education, as well as members with HHS, members of FIRSA, who are working in the field. So, ways to get involved. We talked about ways to get involved at the local level, and at the national level, and in SHAC. If you're a part of a non-governmental organization that's not a member of SHAC, you could ask that organization to consider becoming a member of SHAC, because we could always use more support. If you belong to an organization that is, which includes APHA, then we encourage you to be active. So if you see action alerts coming from APHA related to school health issues, if your members of Congress don't hear from you, they don't think anybody cares. So you need to call. If they are visiting in district and you have a program that is something you can show up, invite them to come and see your program. They love photo ops with kids. So they'll often come to something at a school. This session is sponsored by the School Health Education and Services section. And I would encourage you, if this is an interest of yours, of school health, that you consider becoming a member of SHEES. You can become a member of SHEES even if you are another member of another section within APHA. And then you're likely to hear more about things that are specific to school health. So that's the end of my presentation.
I guess we're going to see if there were...
Yes, so we have time for a couple of burning questions, and then we'll have reserved the majority of the question and answer time for after all the presenters have spoken.
Are there any organizations similar to SHAC that advocate more on the state and local level?
There are organizations that include advocacy at the state and local level in their agendas. SHAC itself, it's a volunteer organization. There's no staff. So they really decided that their focus would be at that level, but hopefully through educating people. I mean, like ASCD, which I mentioned, does the whole child, is a member of SHAC. They're huge. They have state chapters all over the place. AAP is a member. They have state chapters. Now, whether chapters in each state are engaged, a lot of it depends on the leadership in each state. You know, they don't always take direction. Even APHA has chapters in states, and you know, the states may or may not follow the same advocacy agenda as the national.